two sticks standing and one across. Spells Paddy Brennan in the Hillhead Moss. One of the very first poems that I ever heard is about a man on the bog, or a man in the moss, as they would say, in up in the north in my part, in County Derry and all around, the word, the Scottish word, and indeed the Danish, Mosa, it was called going to the moss. And the first moss I went to was Hillhead Moss, and I went there with a guy called Jim Shivers with a donkey and cart to collect the Shivers' turf. But there was a little rhyme which said, two sticks standing and one across, spells Paddy Brennan in the Hillhead Moss. It's about that little fireplace that men on their own would erect out on the bog. Two forked sticks, two Y's stuck into the ground and the stick across, and then the can hung, the can of water hung over the little fire. But I think it's really quite a very beautiful image. It's a poem that that's about absence, as we would say. It's about, it conjures up, I think, for anybody who has been on a bog or a moss, the stillness in the evening, the beautiful, the fragrance, and at the same time, slightly wistful serenity that's over a bog in the evening.
You might as well start with a simple lyric, a simple description of reality, but one that points to a whole and coherent imaginary world beyond it. Ordinary things presented to the mind in an unusual aspect, as Wordsworth had it in his preface to Lyrical Ballads. But how to make it sound so ordinary? Well, the first thing, and this is something Wordsworth also knew, is to find your own ordinary language.
If you say you're writing in your own voice and for your own voice, it doesn't mean that you aren't engaging with the traditional artificial forms, the made-up forms of European poetry or English poetry. You can get your own voice into, you have to get your own voice into the shapes. And for me, the instructor in that area was Robert Frost, who is a master of running the cadence of natural speech across the shapes. The image I used to come up with sometimes was that it was like running vines over a trellis. You had a trellis there and a vine there. The image John McGahern once used to me, he said, you can have the cage, but unless you have the bird, it's not much good.
Stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
All writers start as readers, but what about that nagging feeling that those writers you read were born to it, that the stuff around them was ripe for poetry, and the stuff around you, bogs and sheds and whatever, is just too prosy? It wasn't put there to point beyond itself. It's just the stuff that's there.
Kavanagh's genius achieved what I and my grammar-schooled, arts-degreed generation were badly in need of. A poetry which linked the small farm life that had produced us to the slim volume world we were now supposed to be fit for. He brought us back to what we came from. Kavanagh gave you permission to dwell without cultural anxiety among the usual landmarks of your life. Kavanagh helped to remove what Australians used to call the cultural cringe from Irish writing. When I found Spring the Potatoes in the old Oxford Book of Irish Verse, I was excited. The barrels of blue potato spray, which had stood in my own childhood like holidays of pure colour in an otherwise grey field life, there they were, now standing their ground in print. And there too was the word headland, which I guess was to Kavanagh as local a word as the word headrig was to me. Here too was the strange stillness and heat and solitude of the sunlit fields, the inexplicable melancholy of distant work sounds, all caught in a language that was at once ordinary and odd.
Death of a naturalist. All year the flax dam festered in the heart of the townland. Green and heavy-headed, flax had rotted there, weighted down by huge sods. Daily it sweltered in the punishing sun. Bubbles gargled delicately. Blue bottles wove a strong gauze of sound around the smell. There were dragonflies, spotted butterflies. But best of all was the warm, thick slobber of frog spawn that grew like clotted water in the shade of the banks. Here, every spring, I would fill jampotfuls of the jellied specks to range on windowsills at home, on shelves at school, and wait and watch until the fattening dots burst into nimble swimming tadpoles. Miss Walls would tell us how the daddy frog was called a bullfrog, and how he croaked, and how the mammy frog laid hundreds of little eggs, and this was frog spawn. You could tell the weather by frogs too, for they were yellow in the sun and brown in rain. Then, one hot day, when fields were rank with cow dung in the grass, the angry frogs invaded the flax dam. I ducked through hedges to a coarse croaking that I had not heard before. The air was thick with a bass chorus. Right down the dam, gross-bellied frogs were cocked on sods. Their loose necks pulsed like sails. Some hopped. The slap and plop were obscene threats. Some sat poised like mud grenades, their blunt heads farting. I sickened, turned, and ran. The great slime kings were gathered there for vengeance, and I knew that if I dipped my hand, the spawn would clutch it.
Blue bottles wove a thick gauze of sound around the smell. So the senses are all attuned and the bird is in its cage. But you might need more fortification than that. You need sounding boards and proving grounds and ballast for the road ahead. In 1970, a year Seamus Heaney spent in San Francisco, he found some of these things through his reading of other poets like William Carlos Williams and through conversations with colleagues at Berkeley like Tom Flanagan.
Tom Flanagan, I think what, in that year, talking to him, he's a man of kind of intense intellectual life and also a great raconteur. But also, his whole thinking is, if you like, hibernocentric. I had been used to academics whose thinking was always, in a sense, Anglocentric, you know, that the points of reference were Shakespeare, Wordsworth, Dickens, and so on. Tom's conversation and his mental universe is wide-ranging, but the normative thing at the centre of it is Joyce, if you like, Yeats, the sense of Ireland as the normative place. So I count that year of converse with Tom and reorientation, an important one. So I mean, it wasn't an escape from Ireland in one way. It was a reorienting towards it, and I also poetically got a lot out of being there. I read William Carlos Williams, the poems in a book called Wintering Out, my third book, little poems, very much about my most intimate places like Broch and Ahorish, Tomb, and so on. A lot of those poems came out of reading William Carlos Williams. I don't mean the themes came out of it, but the form, the tentative, short-lined stanzas.
Spring and all. By the road to the contagious hospital, under the surge of the blue, mottled clouds driven from the northeast, a cold wind. Beyond, the waste of broad, muddy fields, brown with dried weeds, standing and fallen. Patches of standing water, the scattering of tall trees. All along the road, the reddish, purplish, forked, upstanding, twiggy stuff of bushes and small trees, with dead, brown leaves under them, leafless vines. Lifeless in appearance, sluggish, dazed spring approaches. They enter the new world naked, cold, uncertain of all, save that they enter. All about them the cold, familiar wind. Now the grass. Tomorrow the stiff curl of wild carrot leaf. One by one, objects are defined. It quickens. Clarity. Outline of leaf. But now the stark dignity of entrance. Still, the profound change has come upon them. Rooted, they grip down and begin to awaken.
Anna Horish. My place of clear water. The first hill in the world where springs washed into the shiny grass and darkened cobbles in the bed of the lane. Anna Horish. Soft gradient of consonant, vowel meadow. After image of lamp swung through the yards on winter evenings. With pails and barrows, those mound dwellers go waist deep in mist to break the light ice at wells and dunghills.
Anna Horish, where the poet went to school, with its soft gradient of consonant, its vowel meadow. This could almost be a physical analogue for the Eden of creativity that Nadine Gordimer talks about in The Essential Gesture. The joyful, playful pleasures of getting the words down right. But of course you can't stay in Eden forever.
I remember when I came back from Berkeley in 1971, internment had just started and so on. There was a huge influx of journalists and so on. We were all being interviewed. And I wrote a number of letters to people in verse. I mean, these were, first of all, letters written for merriment to people I knew. But then they were all put together into a sequence of poems called Whatever You Say, Say Nothing, which became a rather well-known phrase. It was totally ironical, of course. Some dimwits think that it means what it says. So I just read a bit of this. It appeared in The Listener eventually. I put these private letters together into a little public article. I'm writing this just after an encounter with an English journalist in search of views on the Irish thing. I'm back in winter quarters where bad news is no longer news, where media men and stringers sniff and point, where zoom lenses, recorders and coil leads litter the hotels. The times are out of joint, but I incline as much to rosary beads as to the jottings and analyses of politicians and newspaper men who scribble down the long campaign from gas and protest to gelignite and sten, who proved upon their pulses escalate, backlash and crackdown, the provisional wing, polarization and long-standing hate. Yet I live here. I live here too, I sing, expertly civil-tongued with civil neighbours on the high wires of first wireless reports, sucking the fake taste, the stony flavours of those sanctioned old elaborate retorts. Oh, it's disgraceful, surely. I agree. Where's it going to end? It's getting worse. They're murderers. Internment, understandably. The voice of sanity is getting hoarse.
Against the backdrop of such realities, what can the poet do? Well, for a start, you can refuse to adopt the standard positions and work it out through your own established reference points. So what Heaney did was return to the bogs, becoming entranced by images of recently disinterred bodies from Danish bogs, and finding in the bogs a place of repose for himself too, a place where strands of complex histories could work through themselves.
The important accident after that was coming upon the book by P.V. Globe called The Bog People, which is a book about archaeology in Denmark, about bodies found in bogs, bodies which he thought were ritual sacrifices. I say it was accidental. I suppose it was an arranged accident in that I was interested in bogs and so on at the time. But the poems in North, bog poems, I mean, I have talked about them. But the essential thing about them is that they're born out of an obsession with these objects, on the photographs of the objects. And I couldn't quite explain the intensity of my focus on them. Now, you can, and the poems do try to link the actual bodies and the background of violence in the Iron Age, or the background of sacrifice or whatever in the Iron Age, to the contemporary moment. I mean, it attaches them by various little verbal devices in the poems, and just by being written in Ireland at that time, they were linking to what was going on. But they aren't quite political poems, you know.
A Grobal man. As if he had been poured in tar, he lies on a pillow of turf and seems to weep the black river of himself. The grain of his wrists is like bog oak, the ball of his heel like a basalt egg. His instep has shrunk, cold as a swan's foot or a wet swamp root. His hips are the ridge and purse of a mussel, his spine an eel arrested under a glisten of mud. The head lifts. The chin is a visor raised above the vent of his slashed throat that has tanned and toughened. The cured wound opens inwards to a dark elderberry place. Who will say corpse to his vivid cast? Who will say body to his opaque repose? And his rusted hair, a mat unlikely as a fetus's. I first saw his twisted face in a photograph, a head and shoulder out of the peat, bruised like a forceps baby. But now he lies perfected in my memory, down to the red horn of his nails, hung in the scales with beauty and atrocity, with the dying Gaul too strictly compassed on his shield, with the actual weight of each hooded victim slashed and dumped.
The bog poems are perhaps the most scrutinised of all Heaney's works. People looked for and found all sorts of things in them, but what seemed to irk most was the sense that the poet wouldn't say clearly where he stood. He wouldn't simply defend equally all the victims of violence, or point the finger equally at all the perpetrators. Had we not moved on from the Iron Age, could we not expect a little bit more from our poets? Tough charges. But Heaney at least had the comfort of knowing that he was not the first or last writer to face them, and that he could find allies in the writers of Russia and the old Eastern Bloc, among them Ojib Mandelstam.
The sense of life and death importance of poetry, the sense of the demands made by the art, the sense of joy also, the sense of rejoicing in the medium of language. Also, the crisis that Mandelstam faced, which was individual verity versus party demands or commands. No writer could fail to find an echo of that in their life here during the 70s and 80s. He also offered an alternative tribunal, if you like, an alternative center of verification, and I did think that the situation of the Russian writer and eventually then of the Polish writer like Zbigniew Herbert or Miłosz, I thought of their situations in societies which are riven by politics, societies where there is a kind of a fated destiny, whether it be ethnic or national or whatever, and at the same time an imposed condition, the Soviet system or whatever, where the individual self and the political world in which it operates are not harmoniously related.
If the times are out of joint and the writer at odds with society, how does the poet stay on track? What's the proper response? In a sense, what Heaney did was set up his own tribunal. It comes in the form of Station Island, an imagined pilgrimage where, following Dante, the poet encounters and is challenged by the ghosts of his past life. But crucially, the court here is internal to the poetic tradition. The rules are those of conscience, of imaginative consciousness working its way through material. One such ghost that Heaney encounters here is that of his cousin, Colin McCartney, murdered during the Troubles.
Yeah, that's right. This is a second cousin of mine, Colin McCartney, who was shot
Now, I did an elegy for him, and I mean, the elegy was entirely proper at the time, and the elegy goes back to a memory of the strand of a small loch in County Derry where he grew up and where my father used to graze cattle. So I was following his ghost along the strand, which is a traditional literary elegiac principle, that the spirit is revived at the end in some benign landscape. So as an elegy, it was following classical terms, and it was quite true to the man's own gentleness. But the poem itself, as an elegy, as a poem, it reflected the tenderness of the man's personality, all right. But in a sense, it didn't deal with the ugliness of the circumstances which brought him to his death. You know, the actual sectarian ravages which killed him aren't mentioned. So in a way, he's coming back and saying, after that elegy, this is all very well, in a sense, this is beauty. But what about the truth? And those are questions, I think, which any writer always is aware of, especially a lyric poet.
But he had gone when I looked to meet his eyes, and hunkering instead there in his place was a bleeding, pale-faced boy plastered in mud. The red-hot pokers blazed a lovely red in Jerpoint the Sunday I was murdered, he said quietly. Now do you remember? You were there with poets when you got the word and stayed there with them while your own flesh and blood was carted to Billaghy from the fuse. They showed more agitation at the news than you did. But they were getting crisis first-hand, Colum. They had happened in on live sectarian assassination. I was dumb, encountering what was destined. And so I pleaded with my second cousin. I kept seeing a grey stretch of Loch Beg and the strand empty at daybreak. I felt like the bottom of a dried-up lake. You saw that, and you wrote that. Not the fact. You confused evasion and artistic tact. The Protestant who shot me through the head, I accused directly, but indirectly you, who now atone perhaps upon this bed for the way you whitewashed ugliness and drew the lovely blinds of the purgatorio and saccharined my death with morning dew. Then I seemed to waken out of sleep among more pilgrims whom I did not know, drifting to the hostel for the night.
Beauty, truth, ethics and aesthetics. Station Island is heady stuff. At the end of the poem, the final figure who appears is Joyce, as a blind soothsayer in the mode of Tiresias. Not quite absolving Heaney, but telling him to just get on with it. Leave the arena of politics and return to what you know best.
Then I knew him in the flesh, out there on the tarmac among the cars, wintered hard and sharp as a blackthorn bush. His voice, eddying with the vowels of all rivers, came back to me, though he did not speak yet, a voice like a prosecutor's or a singer's, cunning, narcotic, mimic, definite as a steel nib's downstroke, quick and clean. And suddenly he hit a litter basket with his stick, saying, your obligation is not discharged by any common right. What you must do must be done on your own, so get back in harness. The main thing is to write for the joy of it. Cultivate a work lust that imagines its haven like your hands at night, dreaming the sun in the sunspot of a breast. You are fasted now, light-headed, dangerous. Take off from here. And don't be so earnest. Let others wear the sackcloth and the ashes. Let go. Let fly. Forget. You've listened long enough. Now strike your note. It was as if I had stepped free into space, alone with nothing that I had not known already. Raindrops blew in my face as I came to.
Mandelstam has this wonderful phrase in that conversation about Dante, where he talks about the steadfastness of speech articulation. And I remember when I read that being reminded in myself of my own original joy in poetry, which had come from reading Hopkins, which had come from the exaltation of sound somehow, of being being played like some deep instrument by the actual poem, of being in a bodily way moved. And this was a kind of salutary reminder in the 70s, because the problem, poetry had moved from being, if you like, a sensuous transport to being a kind of crisis of, an intellectual crisis of some sort about politics and content and so on. So the phrase, the steadfastness of articulation, stuck with me.
In The Hall Lantern, the book which immediately succeeds Station Island, we can see that return to the original playfulness, the joy of inscape, of evoking images through words and sounds. But we also see a return to the original self, where all the literary journeys started from, and perhaps even echoes of Paddy Brennan and his two sticks standing in the Hillhead Moss.
Alphabets. A shadow his father makes with joined hands and thumbs and fingers nibbles on the wall like a rabbit's head. He understands. He will understand more when he goes to school. There he draws smoke with chalk the whole first week, then draws the forked stick that they call a Y. This is writing. A swan's neck and swan's back make the two he can see now as well as say. Two rafters and a cross tie on the slate are the letter some call A, some call A. There are charts, there are headlines, there is a right way to hold the pen and a wrong way. First it is copying out, and then English, marked correct with a little leaning ho. Smells of inkwells rise in the classroom hush. A globe in the window tilts like a coloured O.
That little gasped O at the end contains much. The child's original wonder at the world and the globe-trotting writer's wonder at the child, the self and its reach.
In fact, I would see the kind of metaphorical shape of all this as an opening outward, as a rippling out from the centre. I mean, I love that bit in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man when Stephen Dedalus writes his address in the back of the book, and he begins, Stephen Dedalus, Class of Elements, Clongowes College, you know, Clain, County Kildare, Ireland, the British Isles, Europe, the world, the universe. And I mean, that has been my own experience, really, of it.
But actually, it's all secondary, you know. Nobody can talk about it. without being mystifying about it, the actual process is a matter of forgetting yourself, you know, and that's eluding your own self-consciousness. Ted Hughes used to say, escaping your own secret, please.
I remember when my father came down to Dublin, my father and mother came down in the early 70s, well, late 70s, it must have been early 80s, when I'd bought this house on Sandy Mount Strand Road, and he went out walking on the Strand, and he had a nice plant. And of course, my father had no sense of James Joyce and Stephen Dedalus. James Joyce and Stephen Dedalus walking into eternity across Sandy Mount Strand, and he has him carrying a nice plant. But after my father died, I thought there he was making a dotted line across the Strand, and maybe That's one way of answering what you're asking me in 100 years' time. I would like a few dots to be on the Strand, and that in those dots would be a poem or two, something that the tide, as the poem says, wouldn't wash away. It's a very short little poem. It's just called The Strand. The dotted line my father's ash plant made on Sandy Mount Strand is something else the tide won't wash away.
The Real and the Imaginary was presented and produced by Owen O'Kelly. It's available to podcast from the Lyric feature page of the RTE website and from other major podcast platforms.
The source material was from the RTE archive, and the poetry readings by Seamus Heaney were from the RTE box set of his collected works as of 2009. His publisher, Faber, has a new updated edition of that box set with a selection of readings from Human Chain, his final work.